Double duty sounds like a pay raise to me. Missed you all last week. I was in the beauty of the Catskill Mountains, where I'd never been before, and it was very nice, but it's nice to be back. Not too far from Camp Katubik, in the town of Kenton, Ohio, a little bit northwest of Columbus, in 1943, there was a baby born to a farmer and his wife. The baby was named Larry Steger. They didn't name him Lawrence, they named him Larry. They liked the name Larry. Larry was the first of his family to go to college, and what a college. He picked Harvard, did quite well. He studied Near Eastern languages and civilizations. I don't know how, I mean, do you grow up saying, I hope I can study Near Eastern languages and civilizations when I'm in college, but I assume he was exposed to them. He was thinking of going into the law, but he went on a dig site, an archaeological site, in postgraduate work. One of his mentors was a man named Benjamin Mazar, and I think many of you have heard of him because he was a supervisor and a helper and consultant in Ambassador College's archaeological digs. And Larry Steger became a fantastic, well-known Bible archaeologist. He changed his name to Lawrence because he didn't get any respect as a Larry, but he died in 2017. But if you look him up, it's always now under Lawrence E. Steger. His co-worker, Daniel Master, who was equally accomplished in the field of archaeology, when he died, said that Lawrence was the most significant biblical archaeologist of the past 40 years. He became the Doro, I mean, that's the name of the chair, professor of archaeology of Israel at Harvard University. He was well known for some of his finds. And bear in mind, I mean, this all happened in our lifetimes. One of the things that he unearthed, and it became quite sensational, I mean, it was covered in the newspapers and things, was he dug up a golden calf that dated from the era of the Canaanites, and it was just as the Bible said. It was an idol, and it helped verify things in the Bible. He also did quite a lot of archaeology in Philistine settlements, and he was one of the ones who, you know, the Philistines have a reputation for being a vulgar, uncouth people. If someone insults my art, I say, oh, you Philistine today, and I feel better. And that actually came from the 1800s. I mean, that was the term. But it turns out that they were quite an accomplished people, and they had their own arts and their own culture and civilization. He teamed up with maritime archaeologist Robert Ballard. How many of you have heard of Robert Ballard? He discovered that little boat called the Titanic. And he also discovered hydrothermal vents down in the bottoms of the oceans. And that he considered that his main achievement. But as his mother said, they're always going to remember you for that rusty old boat. And they did. But when he wanted an archaeologist to team up with exploring Phoenician shipwrecks, he asked Lawrence Steger to do it because he was the man. He had a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge, and he was interdisciplinary. I mean, he combined history and archaeology and all kinds of other things into his papers. There was an article in National Geographic by the two of them called Lost Ships of the Mediterranean. So the man has cred. And I'd like to thank Jeremy Steele. I'm a little embarrassed that it was a TikTok video that made me aware of a paper that Lawrence Steger wrote. I'd heard of him, but I didn't know this paper, which is called The Archaeology of the Family in Ancient Israel. And if you're going to write down anything today, write down The Archaeology, it doesn't matter how you spell it, you're the only one who's going to read it, of the Family in Ancient Israel. Because in some ways, it was one of his biggest contributions. The Israel Museum, after it was published, said this article is foundational to the study of the Iron Age in Israel, both because of the specific ideas presented and especially for its modeling of the untapped possibilities of biblical archaeology Here finally was a person who could move from historical Hebrew grammar, because he was schooled in the languages, to natural sciences with equal ease. And that's one of the things he did. He took the data, he put it together, and he told us what it said. This paper, The Archaeology of the Family in Ancient Israel, you can find it online. I did, and it covers many topics, but it's about, of course, life in those times, roughly from 1200 BC up till about the time of Christ. And there's many topics in it. And it's very interesting. It gives you all kinds of insights to things that actually you read about in the Bible. There's another book that he and a co-author, Philip King, put together called Life in Biblical Israel. And I find this to be very useful because it covers many, many topics with pictures of actual artifacts of the day that bear that have a bearing on our biblical knowledge, and also it just makes things come alive. It helps you understand how people lived, what they ate, what they listened to, what they did during the week, how their families were organized. And that family organization is the part of his paper that I want to talk about today, because among other things, he excavated and also was privy to other scholars' excavations of many houses from that era that covered more than 1,000 years of history, but they seem to have many similarities. The more houses he looked at, the more he realized that there were really some pretty simple floor plans guiding them, not that much different from today, really, that many shared basic floor plans. There were three-room houses, there were four-room houses, and it depends on the person. They didn't spend as much time indoors in those days, and so, they didn't have the hot tub or things like that, but they had pretty basic houses, but they're things that you could recognize. Many of them had pillars, and these pillars, of course, made it possible to make a bigger indoor space, but pillars were also used in the outside walls of them, and many times they would add on barns with the mangers in between the pillars so that animals were actually in their houses. And you run into that from time to time. Here, there's a little reference in 1 Samuel 28, and you know the story, and the story is not what we're going for. We're going for people having livestock in their houses. 1 Samuel 28, and this is the story of what we refer to as the Witch of Endor. But there's just a little detail in it that was borne out by his archaeology. And if you recall, Saul was in a bad way, and the witch decided the man needed a meal. So she was going to fix him a meal. And in 1 Samuel 28 and verse 24, it said, "The woman had a fattened calf." And fattened calf, it really means a stall-fed calf, a calf that was fed and fattened and didn't get out much, you know, kind of like, I won't name names, the person I see in the mirror every morning. It says in my New International, it says, "The woman had a fattened calf at the house." Well, the Hebrew says, and it's pretty clear, the Hebrew says she had a calf in the house. You think, what kind of, she was a witch. Well, of course, she had a calf in the house. But that's the way they did it, was that it was the livestock compounds for the people who didn't have much livestock were built into the house. And that's one of the things that Lawrence Steger found. He found that the architecture of these houses would support second floors. You know, he never didn't find houses with second floors very often. But we find upper rooms in the Bible quite often. Elijah and Elisha lived in an upper room with a widow. And if you recall in the New Testament, Dorcas, when she was raised to life, they had lain her body in an upper room. And upper rooms are named quite a bit throughout the scriptures. Well, it became clear that to Lawrence Steger that the family house often turned into a family compound. And it told us things about the way that family life was arranged. And part of the problem was that, you know, Israel received an inheritance, and then the land was divided up between the descendants. But as time went by, and many years went by, there just wasn't much to be divided up anymore. And so when a son was looking at his prospects, sometimes he had to leave farming and go into things government work or trades or the army or even the priesthood. I mean, they could be adjunct, they could help out the priests and things like that, because there just wasn't land to divide up anymore. So what happened to the houses was that people would have their house, and then the sons, when they had families, they would add on to the houses. Maybe you've seen this. I've seen it down in Amish country, you know, where the grandparents will have an addition on the side of the house where they have the grandparents. But it's a multi-family thing. And it turns out that there was quite a bit of this, that there were many compounds that had numerous generations, four, five, in one case they thought six generations of one family. And there was a name for this, and it was called the Beit Ab. And it's a name that corresponds to other languages too, but in Hebrew it's Beit Ab. And maybe you're familiar with those words because they're pretty common words. Beth, B-E-T-H, Beit, Bethel, Bethlehem. Anybody know what Beth means? House. Bethel is house of God. And so Beit Ab, Ab is the word for father. Tel Aviv, Aviv's fathers, you know, Ab. Jesus Christ called his father Abba. Ab is for father. And so the Beit Ab, the house of the father, was a building block in those days. If you turn to Genesis 24, and again, there's another story going on here, but all we want to do is note the terms. This is where Abraham has sent his servant to find a bride for his son Isaac. So in Genesis 24, and verse 38, the servant is talking to Laban, and in Genesis 24 and verse 38, he says that Abraham had told him that go to my father's family and to my own clan and get a wife for his son. Well, the words there are Beit Ab, go to the house of my father, and find someone for Isaac. And so this was a term that would have been well known and well recognized. One of the places that we see it come into play is in Joshua. Actually, the term Beit Ab doesn't come in, but in Joshua, there's a very, you know, there's a story about a man who had sinned, and they were trying to identify him. And so in the book of Joshua, in chapter 7, again, we're not concerned about the story about the man being identified for his sin. We're concerned about the structure and the way that they did it. And so you see in Joshua 7 and verse 14, it tells how they narrowed it down to one person. In the morning, present yourselves tribe by tribe. And you know what the tribes are. You know, that would be the sons of Israel. The tribe that the Lord takes shall come forward clan by clan. And there's a word for that. And, of course, that would have been a family unit, a large family unit. The clan that the Lord takes shall come forward family by family. And the family that the Lord takes shall come forward man by man. And that's how they narrowed it down to the single person. Well, the building block of the clan was the Beit Ab. The clan was made of various Beit Abs. And we see that there were multiple people living in the compound, that the house was enlarged, and suites were added on, and you could tell by the floor plans that there was more than one house going on at that point. One more reference would be in Judges, since we're in Joshua, Judges, and in chapters 17 and 18. And this is the story of Micah, and it's a weird and terrible story that shows how far Israel had sunk in the era of the judges, because every man did what was right in his own eyes. That's how the book ends. And again, we're not as concerned about the story as we are about Micah and his house, because if you start out in verse 17, there was a man named Micah in the hill country of Ephraim, and this is right where Lawrence Stager did his work. And before you get to the end, you realize that Micah lived with his mother, that he invited a priest to come live with them in his own suite. And then in verse 18, it talks about men, or chapter 18, it talks about the other men who live in his Beit Ab, in his compound. So it was one compound, one stone building, but it had many floor plans in it. And I want to show you some of the floor plans that Lawrence Steger made diagrams of. So this is the time, and we'll just look at a few of them, but I think it'll be obvious. I have a few photos. There's one. And you can see the teeny little squares are the pillars, and the circles are cisterns, and you can see that there's, our daughter bought a house, and she said, I've never lived with more than one bathroom in my life, but now I have three kitchens, three laundry rooms, and four full bathrooms. Well, that's kind of the way this house is. It has at least two kitchens, and it looks like possibly three. You can see up there at the top, there's a self-contained unit with exit and entrance, with its own pillars. And then in the middle, there's another unit that seems to have many of the same features, with possibly a storeroom in between. And then maybe on the bottom, there's a third one. So we might have had three groups living there. Next picture. This one, you can see that at the very top, there's a pillared house with its own floor plan, and then there in the middle, there's another one. So they're independent houses, but they're put together. Let's look at the next one. This one has two. This is a duplex. Lakewood's full of these. But as you can see, the gray shaded area is actually pavement, but there's two living suites there. Next slide. Again, it's hard to tell in this one, but it looks like there's three, possibly four, maybe even more suites built into this single Beit Ab. And then one more. This is a row of townhouses. You can see the pillars are harder to see because they're against a gray background, but you can see that there's at least four and possibly five units there. And thank you very much, Joe. Those came through just fine. You see those floor plans and you realize that's what they were doing, that they were adding on to the houses and building house upon house, but it was all in the Father's house, in the Beit Ab. And of course, this added some complications. If a young man wanted to and woman wanted to get married, there wasn't much to inherit. What would they do? He had to still live with his family to make a living. And so the way that it played out was that there would be a betrothal. There would be an engagement period where they were declared to be betrothed to each other. But then what would happen is the man would take some time, and he would go to that Beit Ab, and he would add on a suite or take some existing rooms and turn them into living quarters. And then he would come back for the wife, and they would go back to the Beit Ab and become part of it. So if we fast forward to the time of the Passover when Jesus died, I want to go to a story in Mark 14, and I totally admit that this is a digression and has nothing to do with the topic. It's just a very cool story. And every time I read it, I think, what on earth was going on there? Because they're getting ready to go to an upper room. You know that Lawrence Steger said the houses could sustain upper rooms, and they could in this case. So in Mark 14, in verses 12 to 16, I don't know what is going on here, but they're getting ready. And in verse 12, on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, when it was customary to sacrifice the Passover lamb, Jesus' disciples asked him, "Where do you want us to go and make preparations for you to eat the Passover?" Well, it seems like Jesus had already made preparations, so why didn't he just say, "Here's the address, put it in your phone, and go find the house?" Instead, I don't know if he's playing with them or if this is really something absolutely wonderful that's going on. He sent two of his disciples telling them, "Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him, and then say to the owner of the house he enters." So he's not the owner. He's just the guide to the owner. "The teacher asks, 'Where is my guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' He will show you a large upper room, furnished and ready. Make preparations for us there." What was he doing? Was he messing with the disciples? Like, saying, you know, "I'm capable of all kinds of things. Here's a last little miracle to show you." Or was it all prepared and he was just having them on? I tend to think it was the last one, that he had prepared it because it was all ready. But just the way they got there, it's like the coin and the fish or something like that. If you don't know what I'm talking about, look it up. Anyway, there they are in the second story, and Jesus is going to have his last Passover on earth. And He had to have, to say the least, mixed feelings about this. He knew the terrible things that were going to happen. He was going back to his father, and if you just go by the words that he said on that night, it seems like his mind is just, I'm leaving, I'm going to my father. That seems to be the main thing on his mind. But of course, we know the other things that happened that night and the following days, and we know how terrible it was for him, and that must have been on his mind too, because there was only one path back to his father, and that was through his death. To say the least, he had all kinds of thoughts going through his head. And one of the things that I just can't get over in the words he speaks in the book of John that we go over on Passover is how many times he mentions the words joy and my joy and your joy. Would you be joyful in that situation? But he knew how it was working out, and he had last words to share with the 11 because the 12th one had already left at that point. So at this point, let's go to John 13. And these are things that are very familiar to you. And in John 13, they have the supper and they do the foot washing. He predicts his betrayal. He sends Judas out, says, what you're about to do, go quickly. And in verse 31, he needs to tell these men the things that the last, you know, he needs to get all the last instructions in. Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. That doesn't sound like a sad person. If God is glorified in him, God will glorify the Son in himself and will glorify him at once. My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You'll look for me. And just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I am going, you cannot come. So he was leaving, and that's what he's telling them. And Peter objected to that and said, I'll go with you wherever you want. And Jesus said, really? And told him a little story about a rooster at that point. So now I turn the page, and I'm at John 14 and verse 1. What does Jesus lead with at this point when he wants to give instructions to his disciples? He leads with the Beit Ab, the house of the fathers. And of course, the words we're reading are in Greek, but Jesus was not speaking Greek. Well, we don't think so. I wasn't there. I don't think Mr. Thomas was even there. It was a long time ago. But probably he was speaking Hebrew or Aramaic. And these words you know, but read them through Lawrence Steger's eyes. John 14, verse 1, do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God, trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the ways to the place where I am going. Father's house in Hebrew or Aramaic would be Beit Ab. And these are the same words that a betrothed man would say to a woman. I'm going to read the same words again, but think of a man saying them to a woman. In my Father's house, there are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you may also be where I am. And that would have played out many times over the history when a to-be-married couple went to the Father's house that had many rooms and built their own house there. And what Jesus is doing is he's inviting, this isn't a mansion in heaven. It isn't even necessarily a literal mansion. Of course, there'll be buildings in the world tomorrow. But Jesus is using terms that they know and understand to say, here at this end of the story or beginning, I am inviting you to be part of God's family, to be part of the family compound. You'll have a place in our home. Then, as now, the message was that you can be in God's family. And what does God want? Malachi 2:15, the two words. What does God want? Godly offspring. It's as simple as that. That was always the message. There's so much more to it, but that's always been the message and the direction. That he gives us the right, as is mentioned in the first chapter of John, the right to become the children of God. It's something that he gives us. Right now, it gives me great comfort to know that I have a brother and a savior, a rescuer, and a king and a husband. I mean, there's all kinds of aspects to our relationship to Jesus Christ, preparing a place for me, that he's at the Beit Ab, and that there's a place being prepared, and that the good news is that he will come back and make us part of the Beit Ab, the house of the Father.